in a fight by starting an argument. I love you all, and I'll see you next time. Peace and justice coming up.
On WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, August 6th. YIGBY stands for Yes in God's Backyard, and it's the name of a new Florida law that allows churches, synagogues, and other religious institutions to build housing on their property regardless of zoning if at least 10% of the units are affordable. In order to be eligible, these institutions must hold public worship on the site, or their housing must be next to one where they do. A Florida Housing Coalition analysis found that around 30,000 parcels across the state could qualify to be open for affordable housing development. In Sarasota County alone, it could be more than 300 parcels that are potentially eligible, and around 450 in Manatee County. The Florida Housing Coalition noted that churches and local governments across the state and nation have already been working in partnership for affordable housing. There are plenty of examples in other states, such as Virginia, Texas, and Georgia. Florida short-term rental occupancy is 8% below the same time last year, showing that the nation's largest vacation rental market is struggling to keep last year's pace. A report by Avantio, a producer of vacation rental software, shows shifting dynamics with domestic guests booking later as they wait to see how economic turbulence evolves and international visitors staying away from the United States. While occupancy for short-term rentals is softening, average daily rates remain the same, according to data from Price Labs. In fact, in the last 7 out of 12 months, revenue per rental has actually increased. Consumer activists urged state regulators Tuesday that FPL's proposed rate hike of almost $10 billion is excessive and should be rejected. In February, FPL submitted a 4-year request to the Public Service Commission proposing to raise base rates after its current rate expires at the end of this year. The Office of Public Counsel told PSC and FPL that if the rate change were to be accepted, FPL should only get about $100 million of the $10 billion it is asking for. Meanwhile, the American Association of Retired People is rallying its members to contact the PSC to urge them to reject FPL's rate request. The AARP started an online petition months ago asking its millions of Florida members who are FPL customers to ask PSC to reject this increase. Public hearings in Tallahassee for the PSC to consider the rate hikes will begin August 11th. The final decision is expected sometime in the fall. This has been Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, August 6th.
It's a humming. Yes, good morning. Good morning. Am I coming through okay, John?
You are from
this,
here.
Yes. So this is the Peace and Justice Report right here on your own community radio station, WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, WBPV 100.1 LPFM in Bradenton. And my name is Bob Connors, and John Dickman is here on the control board. And I have a guest that I'm going to be calling in a little while. And before I call him, I'd like to mention that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. So with that being said, I'm going to read a brief bio on the guest that I'll be calling up. His name is Jeremy Kusmaroff. Over the years, I guess I first had him on about 6 years ago, I believe. And everything sounds good, John. We have the control man, John Dickman, here, and sounding better to me. I don't have a humming in my ear anymore. So let me pull up a brief bio on Jeremy. as I said, he's been on several times in the past. He's written several books. I just want to pull up a couple of them so I can tell you which ones they are. But first, I want to read a little bit about him. So he's a college professor. He's the author of four books on U.S. foreign policy. He's a social critic. And he hopes that people will read his writings and learn something from them and that they can help them broaden in their worldview and raise awareness about various societal issues and injustices. So he has taught at numerous universities and colleges in the field of U.S. history and foreign relations. He has undertaken extensive specialized research on the following topics: covert dimensions of U.S. foreign policy, the war on drugs, U.S. policing and prisons, and the internationalization of U.S. criminal justice, U.S. air power and its human cost, American military base networks, the false manipulations of the public in selling American wars, among other topics. And his publications have appeared in the Progressive Magazine, Counterpunch, the L.A. Progressive, the Huffington Post, and several other magazines. And he's been on many different radio and television programs over the years. And let me just pull up what some of his books are that he has written. We've had him on the show. He talked about the book he wrote on Obama's unending wars, Fronting the Foreign Policy of the Permanent Warfare State. So we talked about that book several years back. There was another book that we talked about. The Russians Are Coming Again, The First Cold War as Tragedy, The Second as Farce. And we're going to be talking about a book today that he just put out about a year and a half ago, Warmonger, How Clinton's Malign Foreign Policy Launched a U.S. Trajectory from Bush 2 to Biden. So I'm going to have John play a song here while I give Jeremy a call, and we'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. Hey, hey!
Creator, you remember, you remember,
Chris. Welcome back. I'd like to mention a few things. I do have Jeremy on the line, but I want to mention that support for WSLR comes from listeners like you and from Manatee Spirit Holistic Sound Studio, offering sound-based wellness experiences in Bradenton. More information is available at 941-201-0069 or info@manateespirit.com. And one other thing I'd like to mention is that the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. So with that being said, Jeremy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I just, before you came on the air, I had read a brief bio and mentioned some of the books that you have written. I know you were on a couple of times over the, well, you've been on several times, but you did talk about your book, Obama's Ending Wars, on our Peace and Justice Report, as well as The Russians Are Coming. And I know you came out with another book recently, about a year and a half ago. It came out on my birthday, January 15th. I have the same birthday as Martin Luther King, so
nice.
It came out on a good day, January 15th.
Yeah.
So, and the title of that book was, tell us all about that book. It's about Bill Clinton, warmonger.
Sure. Yeah, that book is called Warmonger, How Bill Clinton's Foreign Policy Shaped the U.S. Trajectory from Bush II to Biden. And it details, how the Clinton administration, set the groundwork, really, for the horrors of the years of the War on Terror. Actually, there was just a new report put out by the Quincy Institute that showed, military spending had been up 66% since 2000. And I think it's actually close to 99% if you include all the hidden military spending. And the military budget's eclipsed $1 trillion now. The seeds of the imperialistic foreign policy we've seen since 9/11 were set in the Clinton years. And, for instance, I have chapters, on the Middle East and the War on Terror. I mean, Clinton really extended the Reagan War on Terror. And he was promoting, policy that became infamous under Bush, like extraordinary rendition, where they would kidnap alleged terrorist suspects and send them to countries with brutal leaders like Egypt under Mubarak and Jordan, Syria, where it was known that they would be tortured. And he was bombing Iraq incessantly and, set the ground. And he applied devastating sanctions on Iraq. Madeleine Albright admitted the Secretary of State caused the deaths of 500,000 children. He was continuing a program of regime change in Iraq using, cruel methods, that was extended, by Bush. And, I go into the Balkan conflict. That was really a dirty war. A lot of, liberals unfortunately supported that war. But it was designed to really establish U.S. military bases in the Balkans and break up the Yugoslav Federation. The Serbs have been trying to keep the Yugoslav Federation together as a kind of independent entity like it had been under Tito. Tito had placed Yugoslavia in the non-aligned movement, not in the Western orbit, not in the Soviet orbit either, an independent, country with a flourishing economy. So the U.S. goal was to dismember, it was a long-standing goal of U.S. policy planner to dismember Yugoslavia, divide and conquer and establish U.S. military bases and greater power in the region as a gateway, into Europe and the Mediterranean. And so that was really the goal. And there was a lot of, the bombing that Clinton ordered killed a lot of civilians, displaced a lot of people. And the U.S. was supporting jihadists. Another feature that we see, in the present that Clinton, set in motion was a, what we see generally is a lot of continuity, in U.S. foreign policy. As much as Americans get riled up over partisan politics, we see great continuity, whether it's a Republican or Democrat. So scrutinizing Clinton foreign policy, you see he's just continuing a lot of the patterns of Reagan and setting in motion patterns that were extended by Bush and Obama and Biden and Trump. So, you know, he's supporting jihadists in the Balkan. The U.S. brought in jihadists from the Middle East to fight against the Serbs, and some were Al-Qaeda elements. And the Kosovo Liberation Army had been branded as a terrorist organization by the State Department before the Clinton administration ramped up support to it. And there were also like Al-Qaeda elements supporting the Kosovo Liberation Army. And these were presented, you know, as humanitarian interventions, and some liberals bought it. The other aspect was that he's using a more light footprint approach, because, I mean, the public after Vietnam was kind of weary of, you know, large ground invasion of foreign countries. So he was able to get away with these wars by using a light footprint approach, relying more and more on technologies like drones, air power, proxy forces, rather than direct U.S. combat troops. So there wasn't much of an anti-war opposition, and that's kind of a formula followed by a lot of other presidents, including Obama. The first chapters go into Clinton's background and show how he was essentially a creation of the CIA, that when he was a governor of Arkansas in the 80s, Arkansas was a key state in the Iran-Contra, the illegal arms smuggling to the right-wing Contras who were trying to sabotage the left-wing Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua. And there were clandestine arms flights that he allowed from MENA, Arkansas, the western part of the state. And they were also bringing back drugs, and money was being laundered into local area banks by some of Clinton's friends. And Hillary Clinton represented them as a partner in the Rose Law Firm. So there's a lot of corruption in Clinton's Arkansas, and that sets the groundwork for what we saw in his presidency, where it's, you know, a pay-to-play system and just a kind of orgy of corruption. So it's not a very positive reflection, unfortunately, on American politics, but sadly that's the reality. We need more mobilization of popular movements against this corruption and these predatory forces that have taken over our government.
Well, I know that you refer to yourself as a liberal, more left wing than anything, and you've written the books on Obama and Clinton now. You know, somebody from the outside might look at that and say, wow, hey, we know where he stands politically. But as you said, it doesn't really matter, does it? Whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in the Oval Office, it's the same type of same policy, the military-industrial complex. And why all the research you have done, why does this continue? Why did it begin in the first place that the U.S. feels as though they have to be the policemen of the world?
I think you have to look in part at the structural economic forces. I mean, Franklin, who controlled the U.S. government and their interests, Franklin Roosevelt said that, you know, a banking elite had controlled the United States since at least the time of Andrew Jackson. And, I mean, war is a very profitable business for them. And now you have these Wall Street hedge funds who own these big tech firms like Palantir that are profiting more and more off war. And, you know, the big five defense contractors. And, you know, behind them are these Wall Street firms and this banking elite that has made an absolute fortune. And they're behind political figures like Clinton. I mean, Clinton had even tied with the Rockefeller family. He was groomed by Winston Rockefeller, was a governor. He was a member of the Rockefeller dynasty who was the governor of Arkansas in the 1960s. And there was a family connection with his best friend in World War II was related to Clinton and may have introduced Clinton to Winston Rockefeller. And they saw the promise in Clinton because Clinton, you know, he had the skill of a good politician. I mean, We don't necessarily always see that. I don't think Hillary Clinton, frankly, had those skills, but Bill had it. He could go into rural Arkansas, give a talk, and win over the people. He could speak to different audiences. I mean, he was a BSer, you know, and people who knew him recognized that, that he was always BSing, and, you know, they said he's an uncommonly good liar. And the head of the Labor Federation in Arkansas said he'll slap you on the back and piss down your leg. But that made him a good politician because he could give a good speech, and people believed he was on their side, even though he would sell them out. I mean, really, he was on the side of the oligarch, the billionaires, including in Arkansas, yeah, what I traced in the early chapters, yes, his ties with Winston Rockefeller, his connection with the big heavyweight, economic heavyweights in the state, particularly Walmart, Tyson Chicken, Stevens Investment House, which is the largest investment house outside of Wall Street, owned by Stevens Brothers, who are connected with the CIA. They also own the Systematics, which is a CIA data mining company. So these are the people who are supporting Clinton and who ultimately he was loyal to, but he was very good, people person, whereas Hillary is not. So they saw the talent. I think Winston Rockefeller saw the talent. They saw he could go far. So they used him for their purposes. And I think, you know, Obama had a certain talent, too, and a certain appeal, especially given the ugly racial history. A lot of the liberals especially were ready for a black president, and they wanted to, you know, I think Obama conveyed the impression that, oh, America's over its racial problem. Look, we can grow as a country. We have a black president. And, you know, he had a certain charisma as well. But, you know, there are powerful financial interests who are financing these political figures, and ultimately they're hoodwinking the public. I think we have to look at those structural forces as to why Democrats, as much as Republicans, are adopting imperialistic foreign policies and frequently hoodwinking the public.
You know, when Bernie Sanders was running, I got the impression, I might have read this someplace, but it just seemed that the Democrats would have preferred not having Bernie Sanders and even having a Republican elected if Bernie Sanders ever got the nomination, just because maybe he wasn't tied in to what you're talking about as much as or is maybe not as controllable as Clinton and Obama turned out to be.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, Sanders is not perfect either. I've done some research on his background. He was connected with this real estate tycoon in the state of Vermont, Tony Pomerleau, and he often supported wars when it was Democrat. Like, he supported the Kosovo bombing and the wars in the 90s and, like, Libya, Syria. But he did condemn wars like Iraq waged by Republicans. I agree with you. Yeah, he did have more left-wing philosophy, a little more independent, willing to challenge corporate interests. So, as you say, they had to make sure he didn't get in, and they used all kinds of trickery, as we've seen, to prevent that from happening.
You know, even when Iraq happened and it was proven, you know, many people knew right away that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, but they were eliminated from hearing by the mainstream media. I think it out of 400 people that appeared on NBC, CBS, NPR, PBS, it was like three or four of those people who got on the air out of 300 or 400 were people speaking out against the war. So would that be a prime example of the military-industrial complex, the banking industry, all those people who control what goes on in the U.S., was that a clear example right there, the way we went into Iraq when there was no justification whatsoever?
Absolutely, yeah. And, yeah, control of the media is very crucial. And they, you know, the media has been, and Clinton passed the Telecommunications Act that allowed increasing, consolidation of corporate control over the media. I remember I read something about the New York Times, which is supposedly more liberal, but there was a study in their op-eds as far as Iraq. Yeah, it was like 9 to 1 pro-war. And the one was a guy who used to be a columnist named Bob Herbert, who wrote, who's an African American, who wrote purely about domestic issues and the potential domestic costs of the war. You know, nothing about how oil was behind it or what it might do to Iraqis or, you know, what U.S. foreign policy had done to Iraq already at that point with the bombing of the first Persian Gulf War and sanctions and bombing under Clinton. So it wasn't exactly a strong anti-war position either to help educate the American public about the often terrible effects of U.S. foreign policy and imperialistic nature of it. And so, control over the media really is absolutely crucial. And we see that, you know, continuously in the present day. I mean, all the liberal media has just been on the anti-Russia bandwagon for the last decade. And even amidst more and more, you know, declassified documents showing that there was basically a conspiracy to manipulate public opinion, and that even the intelligence agencies didn't have any hard proof of Russian intelligence interference, and their assessments were showing that Putin didn't like either candidate in that election, let alone favoring Trump, which there's no evidence of, and he may have actually held back damaging information about Hillary Clinton and her health and anger management fits. Even amidst that evidence, they disregard that, and they are still pushing this anti-Russia theme, and they're giving a platform to the architects of the Russiagate conspiracy and new Cold War, figures like John Brennan and James Clapper. You know, for instance, the New York Times, which I read every day, yesterday or the day before, had this big op-ed by Brennan and Clapper, attacking Gabbard and pushing this anti-Russia line and, you know, the Russian election interference, when it's like the WMD. There's no evidence of this at all, and it's just used to manipulate public opinion into hating Russia and supporting the billions of arms to Ukraine, which is another sinkhole, you know, a waste of our taxpayer money, billions of dollars that could have been invested in our schools, in helping the homeless program for the homeless, in developing health care system, high-speed rail, environmental cleanup. That's where the money should have gone, not into the most corrupt government in Ukraine that's, you know, into threatening World War III, and it's caused over a million deaths. So this Russiagate is very deadly, just like the WMD lie, and that's, you know, the venality of this elite, that they lie and manipulate public opinion in support for policies that are antithetical to humanity and antithetical to the interests of the American public as well.
Well, you can speak about what happened during the Clinton presidency that kind of led to the Ukraine-Russia situation.
Well, that's another area Clinton set in motion the groundwork for the new Cold War because of his disastrous decision to expand NATO past, into Eastern Europe. And the previous administration, George H.W. Bush, made an agreement with Mikhail Gorbachev when he's still the Soviet premier, and a promise that the U.S. would not expand NATO eastward with the end of the Cold War. Because NATO, you know, was always viewed in Russia as a hostile military alliance that threatened their security interests. So that, you know, promise by Bush could have set the groundwork for an era of peaceful relations between the United States and Russia. But Clinton, instead, you know, you had lobbying by the military industrial complex. He had certain ethnic communities Clinton was trying to court, like the Polish and Lithuanian, certain states that had a hatred for Russia, that favored NATO expansion, and that may be the reason Clinton went forward and expanded NATO against that promise into three countries. Czechoslovakia was one, I think Poland, maybe Romania, if I'm not mistaken. And that really inflamed the Russians. And, you know, George Kennan had said that that was a mistake. You know, Kennan was the, you know, grandfather of U.S. Foreign policy in the Cold War, the author of the containment doctrine that provided a basis for U.S. strategy in the Cold War. And he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times warning against NATO expansion, that it would be a disaster, that it would fuel nationalistic elements within Russia and lay the seeds for a new Cold War. And that's exactly what happened. But Clinton went ahead with it. And unfortunately, the peace movement was not mobilized in this period. They should have raised more hell when Clinton was moving in that direction and staged rallies and protests. But the peace movement was kind of dormant in the 90s. But that was really a crucial policy, and it signaled to Russia that the United States was, you know, hostile and intent ultimately on carving up Russia. And that's what was going on in the 90s. Clinton also he supported his shock therapy programs, and they sent, like, the Harvard boys were pushing these neoliberal privatization initiatives that was ultimately ruining the Russian economy and allowing Western corporations and Wall Street financiers to come to dominate Russia's economy and even to gain a foothold on controlling Russian natural resources and Russian company like Russian oil companies. And that was another alarm bell that the Russians were losing their economic sovereignty. And that's why Putin adopted a more nationalistic course when he took over after Boris Yeltsin in 2000. And then Putin, you know, they started demonizing him and going after him because they wanted a weak leader like Yeltsin who would further the process that the Clinton administration was initiating, whereby U.S. companies could take over Russian natural resources and Russia would be left a very weak country, which is what the U.S. government has wanted.
So that's more or less the reason why U.S. has been supporting Ukraine when this all began 3 or 4 years ago, but it's been going on right along. But I know that you had mentioned this when you were on our show a few years back, and I've had several other guests mention the same thing, and I think it's common knowledge now that an agreement was in the process of being signed by Russia and Ukraine that there would be no war if Ukraine committed not to join NATO, and Boris Johnson was flown in or went in to make sure that did not happen because the U.S. had no interest in that happening. Is that all pretty factual now?
Yeah, it started with Clinton because, you know, Victoria Nuland said at one point, you know, in the late 20-teens, we invested, you know, $5 billion in Ukraine since the end of the Cold War to try and pry it away, you know, from the Russian orbit and into the pro-Western camp. And that started under Clinton. And, you know, the National Endowment for Democracy was very active as one way to try and achieve that goal, and USAID and other, you know, soft power as well as some hard power. So the Clinton administration started that of trying to pry Ukraine away from the Russian orbit, which, you know, Russia saw Ukraine more rightfully in its sphere. And then that was intensified really with the coup, you know, because in 2010, Ukraine elected a pro-Russian leader, Viktor Yanukovych, and then the Obama administration supported the coup against him in 2014. And then the eastern provinces of Ukraine are more tied in with Russia, culturally, economically, and they didn't go along with the coup and they voted for their autonomy. And then the Western Ukraine started attacking them with U.S. weapons. And then prior to the Boris Johnson visit you're describing, there was the Minsk peace framework that could have resolved the conflict by granting some autonomy to the eastern Ukrainian provinces in the east, and also granting them, because one thing they were concerned about was the pushing of the Ukrainian language in the schools there. So in the Minsk agreement, that would have given them the right to teach in Russian. But again, the U.S. was not interested in a resolution. And Angela Merkel admitted, the then German chancellor, that they signed the Minsk agreement only to buy time to build up Ukraine military capability. And I think that signaled they were using Ukraine as kind of a bulldog to attack Russia and try and, you know, weaken Russia and create a conflict that would bog. I think the strategy was similar to Afghanistan in the 90s. They wanted to bog the Russians in the Ukraine, you know, quagmire, and that would deplete their treasury. And also they could ratchet up sanctions and weaken its economy and isolate it. And at the same time, you know, support the opposition to Putin, pro-Western figures like Alexei Navalny. And, you know, he was promoted. There was a lot of celebration of Navalny in the Western media, and money was covertly going into his organizations. And he favored the weakening of the Russian Federation, including, you know, he supported separatist movements to weaken the Russian Federation, and I think he opposed the war in Ukraine, you know, Russia's involvement in any way in Ukraine, and adopted more pro-Western and neoliberal positions. And he was also a xenophobe. They tried to depict him as like a Mandela-type figure when he was featured in videos calling immigrants cockroaches, basically, you know, supporting like a Trump-type anti-immigrant agenda with, you know, racist rhetoric. But that was kind of airbrushed in these sanitized accounts, including there's some film about him. I didn't see it, but I think it won major awards and it presented him as like a Nelson Mandela. And then they created this fabrication that he was poisoned. And also he was, him and his brother were involved in some corrupt schemes, that put them in prison, but they made like he was purely a political prisoner, when they had embezzled money and were involved in a fraudulent mail scheme to make money. And Navalny, I think, had also embezzled money from some of the political organizations. So he was not a savory character. But anyway, their strategy was to try and ultimately get him in, instead of Putin, who's more nationalistic.
You know, when I got you on the phone about a half hour ago, I had told you I had a song I wanted to play halfway through our interview. I'm going to give you a break and give the listeners an introduction to this musician, Jesse Wells, who does a lot of social justice music. But the title of this song is War Isn't Murder, and this is Jesse Wells. And we'll be back in a couple of minutes, Jesse. Enjoy the music. Thank Jesse. You.
War isn't murder. Good men don't die. Children don't starve and all women survive. War isn't murder. Well, that's what they say when you're fighting the devil. Murder's okay. War isn't murder. They call casualties. There ain't a veteran with a good night's sleep. Let's talk about dead people. I mean a dead people. The dead don't feel honor. They don't feel that brave. They don't feel events. They're lucky if they got graves. Call your dead mother, ask her when she died. It's a deadly silence on the other line. The dead don't talk, but the children don't forget. So in 20 short years, you could live to regret that. War isn't murder, there's money at stake. Hell, even Kushner agrees it's good of real estate. War isn't murder, as Netanyahu, he's got a song for that and a bomb for you. War isn't murder, it's an old desert faith. It's a nation state sanctioned righteous hate. Let's talk about dead people. I mean a dead people.
War isn't murder, it's the vengeance of God. If you can't see the bodies, they don't blow when they rot. And the flies don't swarm, and the children don't cry. If war isn't murder, good men don't die. So in a short 20 years, when you vacation the strip, don't think about the dead, and have a nice trip. Tom Hanks. War isn't murder, they don't ship out the poor, and the bullets they fire aren't part of the cure. War isn't murder, land is a right, but the bank's called dibs, it's something you can't fight. Let's talk about dead people, I mean a dead people. The dead don't feel honor, they don't feel that brave, they don't feel avenged, they're lucky if they got graves. War isn't murder, ain't a river of blood, stretching all through time and raining down in a flood. It's a dark sacrifice made on your behalf, so get down on your knees and thank the sweet Lord that war isn't murder.
Yes, this is the Peace and Justice Report, and that was Jesse Wells, War Isn't Murder. How'd you like that, Jeremy?
That was terrific. That's really great.
Yeah, I tell you, it's amazing. It's amazing. It's okay to have innocent people killed all around the world and have the military-industrial complex continue to do what they're doing. Is you said it a while back, all this money could be used to improve the lives of the average American. Well, the homeless people, the vets who cannot get a job when they come home and they're permanently disabled from being in the throes of war somewhere around the world. But I want to mention that Jeremy is the co-editor of Covert Action Magazine. I did not mention that in your brief bio before I got you on the phone, Jesse. I'm calling you Jesse, but Jeremy, why don't you talk a little bit about Covert Action Magazine?
Okay, sure. Yeah, Covert Action Magazine was founded in the 70s by a CIA whistleblower named Philip Agee, who wrote a book I would highly recommend, yeah, called Inside the Company, a CIA Diary, which was a kind of tell-all expose of what the CIA was really up to with American taxpayer dollars, all kinds of skullduggery and illegal activities. He was mostly based in South American countries where he was involved in coups and torture, on behalf of multinational corporations, as he said. So then he helped found the magazine with Lewis Wolf, was an underground journalist from the Vietnam War, and they founded with some others Covert Action Magazine to expose the depredations of the CIA, the so-called deep state, and provide critical analysis on U.S. foreign policy. And the magazine, Philip Agee died in 2009. But in 2018, his son with Lewis Wolf, who's still alive, is in his 80s now, they refounded it as a webzine. And we published five articles, and I'm the editor of the webzine, and we publish five original articles every week, mostly focused on U.S. foreign policy, the CIA, and also some, we try and feature whistleblowers as well. I was just at a whistleblower conference in Washington for National Whistleblower Recognition Day. So I have an article on that. And there's another whistleblower I've profiled. We've done some profiles of whistleblowers on top of coverage of critical coverage of U.S. foreign policy and the military industrial complex.
You know, I pulled an article up just this morning when I was thinking about the Russiagate situation that you had written with James Bradley back in November of 2021 on Ray McGovern. Of course, most people who are peace activists are familiar with Ray McGovern. He's been a leading peace activist from, you know, way back when. And the title of the piece was "The Man Who Got Russiagate Right and Tried to Warn the Public to No Avail." And so, you know, this information has been out there for years. I know there, a couple of years ago, Matt Taibbi had revealed a lot of this information as well. And, you know, he got castigated for it, like he gets castigated quite a bit. There's another example of somebody like yourself who's leaning left, left-wing journalist, and he comes out with some information, some research he has done, and has written an article. Then he brought up before a congressional committee, and I can remember what Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you know, cross-examining him and say, "Well, you're here on the behalf of the Republicans," so. You know, I remember Debbie Wasserman Schultz way back when, after we invaded Iraq, and she, along with many other Democrats, was speaking out against the Iraq war every night in Congress. You know, that like so many Congress people would stay, and they just go for, you know, they'd all talk for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And I got the impression way back then she was a big peace person, but she's just told such a politician that whatever the Democrats do is right, whatever the Republicans do is wrong. And if you're an independent journalist and you come up with independent research and take one side rather than the other, you're a traitor. What do you think of that mentality? Am I correctly categorizing Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I didn't know she was against the Iraq war, but I've seen a lot of ugly things from her. I mean, when she was the head of the Democratic National Committee, she was involved in undermining Bernie Sanders through thoroughly undemocratic means and, you know, slurs against him. I've also covered speeches by her. You know, I was doing an article on the anti-Castro, you know, Cuba lobby that's for regime change, and she gave a strong speech supporting the hard right, you know, Cuba lobby that wants regime change for many years and supports a harsh embargo on Cuba that has caused a lot of economic misery. She also used red baiting. I attended a hearing with some FBI whistleblowers. And yeah, they were pointing out certain things, yeah, that are, I guess, inconvenient for liberal Democrats or challenge their worldview, because they were talking about how the FBI was manipulating statistics about January 6th and to play up the threat of domestic violence extremism to get more funding for themselves. You know, they play up threats, whether it's Islamic terrorism, and they may be real threats. I mean, there are real white supremacist groups, but they use the same strategy, even, you know, manipulating statistics. That's what they were saying. You know, they weren't in favor of white supremacy, but they were saying how the FBI, they reported just how the FBI was misleading, you know, that its data was misleading and some of its practices were wrong, and they got fired at a congressional hearing. And she attacked them as Russian agents. She was using red baiting, which probably she did with Matt Taibbi. And that's, you know, like McCarthyism, you know, and it's the reverse. You know, the original McCarthyism was led by a Republican, you know, attacking liberal left people as Russian agents or dupes. And now we see Democrats doing that, attacking sometimes more conservative people or whistleblowers or just good journalists. It's a way to discredit their journalism, which is pointing to certain inconvenient truths or to discredit these whistleblowers. So it's really ugly, yeah, and it should be called out. And she'd been a huge supporter of the Russiagate and the Ukraine fiasco, and this is, should be regarded as a crime against humanity. I mean, a lot of the activism has centered on the Israel-Gaza for good reason, but it should extend to Ukraine. I mean, look, there are a million deaths probably as a result of Russiagate and the Ukraine-Russia conflict, which, as you were pointing out, was totally avoidable with either the Minsk framework or the agreements that Johnson squelched. If those agreements had gone forward, it would have saved at least a million lives, and that whole region has been devastated. And the people of Ukraine have lived under attack since 2014. I was in Russia, and I watched some documentaries when I was there that we don't get access on our TV, and they're based on grounded reporting that these people had to live in underground shelters, and the kids couldn't go to school because they were being constantly bombarded by the Ukrainian army with U.S. weapons after the coup, and, of course, extending through the war that broke out in 2022. So life has been, and so many people have been killed. I did a story on a ballerina who was coming out of a very gifted ballerina, was coming out of practice, a 12-year-old girl, and was struck by a Ukraine missile and killed with her coach and her grandmother, who had taken to her ballet practice. And it's a terrible story. And, these stories are not being reported in the media outlets, including alternative media have been totally silent about the humanitarian catastrophe in eastern Ukraine. So, Schultz is behind that and slaughter, from my point of view, and is culpable, as any other politician, because she's been at the forefront of this, as you say, this red baiting, and supporting these abhorrent, morally abhorrent policy. And I don't know her position. I would assume she's also very pro-Israel, arming Israel, and that genocide, which is another horror show. So, I mean, she's, deeply, deeply committed, complicit in war crimes, and it's really a more example of the morally abhorrent people who really, sold their soul for access to power.
I think you just said it right there. If I was going to ask you, why does this continue? I mean, it just boggles my mind. I mean, they had, the military budget was increased by so much. When Trump was running, he said, I'm going to end the Ukraine-Russia war as soon as I get into office. And now he is just doing what Biden was doing, and just keep it going and continuing to provide more money, more weapons to Ukraine and Israel. I mean, what is... There's only so much you can say, Jeremy. What are we going to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, we need a much bigger pushback. And as I pointed out in my Obama book, in the concluding chapter, I discuss how, the problem is not the individual, Obama or Clinton. I mean, yes, these are opportunists. They rode the wave, and they were the spokesman for some abhorrent policies. But the problem, is structurally rooted in the American economy. And I think I drew on the writing of Seymour Melman, who is a brilliant economist at Columbia University, and he wrote a lot of books on Pentagon capitalism. And as a solution, he was developing plans for transform the American economy. I think with the peace movement, I mean, they should continue certainly, opposing the Gaza Holocaust and opposing arms to Ukraine. But I think they need to develop a plan and a program and push this plan before the public. As far as transforming the American economy from a war-rooted economy to a peace economy. And Melman was developing these blueprints in some of his writings, and he developed plans like companies like Boeing, plans to, instead of building more and more missiles, that they should build, you know, subway cars. And I think he was actually working. Like, he's not just an intellectual who wrote good books about this. And he developed some concrete ideas about how certain companies could transition. Because these companies employ very skilled scientists, skilled engineers, and probably a lot of the people who work at those companies would prefer to use their talents to build something they could be proud of, like cutting-edge transportation technology or stuff that could be used to benefit the environment in different ways, including things like carbon capture. So that's the challenge, to get these companies to use that brain power for that instead of building these missile systems. And, you know, and Melman explained that it was bad for the economy, you know, that the military-industrial complex ultimately harmed the manufacturing vitality of the country, and there are various reasons for that that he explained. And he was actually working with business executives and some political figures to, you know, develop plans for instituting his ideas. And he was connected with the Speaker of the House, Jim Wright, from Texas, I believe a Democrat from Texas, who had been kind of on the hawkish side early in his career, but came around to embracing Melman's plan. Unfortunately, they manufactured a scandal. Once Jim Wright was starting to push some ideas in Congress, and he was building a coalition in Congress, Newt Gingrich was behind some dirty tricks they played on Wright, and they manufactured a financial scandal that ruined his political career that was kind of phony. And some other politicians either aged out of power. Like, there was a guy from New York, Ted Weiss, who was involved with Melman and was pushing some of his ideas. He was a congressman. I think he aged out of office or something. So it didn't continue. But I think that is the right approach, personally, for the peace movement to take, that we need to develop plan, because that's the problem, is that the U.S. economy and a lot of the prosperity, at least among certain segments, is rooted in the war economy. So if we can transition to a peace economy, take the profit out of war, you know, short of a socialist revolution, which may be unrealistic at this time, I think that's what the peace movement should do. So I would recommend people read Melman's writings and what he was saying about this, and work ultimately to build coalitions, including with people in industry and in government, whether state government or ultimately national government. And there may be receptivity to that in industry and even in the scientific community, because scientists, again, a lot of people may work for Boeing or Lockheed because that's the only job they could get, or that pays well. But they would rather be doing, you know, making subway cars or whatever it is, so, you know, some important technologies for use in the civilian economy. So, civilian life. So anyway, that's just my idea.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I threw that out to you. That's great. Yeah. Imagine what a different country and world it would be. And Jeremy, we're out of time, and I want to direct people to your website, jeremykuzmarov.com. Let me spell your last name, K-U-Z-M-A-R-O-V, jeremykuzmarov.com, and that'll lead you to Covert Action Magazine. So thank you so much, Jeremy, for being on today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, we'll talk again then. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, Jeremy does a lot of research. If you read any of his articles on Covert Action Magazine, they are filled with information. They go on and on. It's not a short 3 or 4 paragraph article that he presents. It's many, many pages on any subject that he tackles. He gets into it deeply, as well as the books that he has written. So I'm really happy he was on today. I hope you enjoyed the show. This was Tom Walker's week, but he's away, so for the month of August. So I'll be Walker's week, but he's away, so for the month of August. So I'll be back next week with the Peace and Justice Report, and have a great day, Wednesday.